So I ought to start by telling a few jokes, but you've come to the wrong place. That's in the other room. Hello, I'm Adrian Goldberg. Welcome to the first edition of Adrian Goldberg's talk show live tonight at the Glee Club in Birmingham. Now, our guest tonight is Pat Murphy, and I just want a little personal word about Pat Murphy. He's worked for the BBC for many years. I was active in campaigning against the identity card scheme that some of you may remember the Thatcher government was keen to impose on football. And Pat gave me a platform in the late 1980s on Radio 5 to explain why, as an ordinary football fan, I was opposed to that idea. And unlike many people in the media at that time, he was sympathetic, he was encouraging and keen to hear what ordinary football fans had to say. Little did I know that in a few years' time he would become a colleague of mine on the radio. Now, as a member of the Test Match Special Team and a Five Live reporter, Pat has covered 18 England overseas cricket tours. He's also written a book called The Greatest Season. It's about Warwickshire's 1994 treble winning season. In the world of football, he's covered the Midlands football scene for many decades, and of course, Brian Clough, with whom he formed a special bond, and he's got some great stories about Cloughy. So, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Pat Murphy. Let's start with cricket, Pat, because obviously you've had these massive number of overseas tours. You've got your lovely book over there, A Fiver Off Tonight. Did I mention that? But
number 44, by the way. Number 44.
Warwickshire's 1994 season, the treble-winning season, Brian Lara. It was an incredible season. But I was covering Warwickshire for Radio WM at the time as well. It was brilliant cricket, but there was a hell of a lot going on behind the scenes, wasn't there?
We all love an anniversary, don't we, in sport? So this was an obvious chance to do it. I was very lucky. A lot of these people were and remain my friends. There were so many interesting aspects going on. They didn't always get on with each other, you know. One thing that, looking back, that really struck me, how many of them smoked and how many of them liked a bevy as well. Now, they were very, very good cricketers, and they had one genius, one great player as well. But I love that chemistry about the fact that Harold Wilson, when he was Prime Minister, once referred to creative tensions in the Cabinet. There were a lot of creative tensions in that Warwickshire dressing room. But when they crossed the white line, it didn't seem to matter. That common goal was there. But it might never have happened in terms of that fantastic success, three trophies out of four, runners-up in the fourth, if Brian Lara had not been signed just at the right moment. Because Warwickshire had given up on Manoj Prabhakar, he'd got an injury, so he said, we can't have you as the overseas player. This young lad, Lara, scoring a few runs. MJK Smith, the chairman of Warwickshire, was out there at the time, England manager of the Test team. And they did a deal whereby they signed up Lara for £40,000. Now, in 1994, that wasn't much. The going rate for overseas players was about £50,000. They did the deal just before the Antigua Test match. And then Brian Lara scored 375. So straight after that Test match, they would have not have got him for £150,000 because he was then the world record holder. And I'm told that the membership subs went through the roof and they signed sufficient amount of members to make £120,000. So Warwickshire made 80 grand profit after getting a genius and the best cricketer in the world. But to make it even more knife-edge, Mike Smith, famously absent-minded, lost the contract, Lara's contract, just before the Test match. He's thinking, oh, shit, what are we going to do? He's got all these runs. His agent's going to be asking for more money. The chambermaid had taken the contract and put it away for safekeeping. I hope she got a massive, massive tip. But that shows you how slender the threads are between success and failure. And in Warwickshire's case, fantastic achievement in the county championship history.
We were just talking in the dressing room about one or two Warwickshire players who were rather more than a bevy at the time.
Recreational substances, I believe the phrase is. And sometimes, it's on record now, sometimes you found yourself thinking, I'm interviewing this particular player, I'm thinking, has he been to Colombia overnight? He's smelling, his dressing room is smelling rather sweet. It just didn't seem to matter, though. Bob Woolmer presided over the whole thing benignly. And it just worked. Opposites attract. And And they'd spent some time getting a decent side organised. They won the NatWest the year before. But yes, Adrian, subsequently, I think Warwickshire, if there was a league table for county sides that went slightly beyond the legal pale in the next 5 years or so, it would have been Warwickshire in that particular period. For me, that actually added to the interest because they remained interesting guys, and meeting up with them and talking to them. Trevor Penny, I rang him in Montreal. Andy Moles in Afghanistan. Hold up in Kabul. Dougie Brown out in the United Arab Emirates and Dubai. It's been great for me actually catching up on all these guys. None of these three, by the way, can I just say, were part of that illegal substances group. I need to absolve all those from criticism. But it's been a labour of love for me, and the easiest book I think I've ever written.
You did write as well an autobiography, or biography rather, of Ian Botham. You went on some of his walks as well, Sir Ian Botham.
Sir Ian Botham, indeed, starting over the leukemia research walk in 1985. John McGroats to Land's End. I joined at various stages and retreated ignominiously with groin strains and all sorts of things, but also doing a bit of work for the radio at the same time. But, you know, 584 miles, I think it was, in 5 weeks. Absolutely remarkable achievement. Absolutely amazing. One of the tabloid guys, Chris Lander, he was going to walk one day, left his car at John McGroats, and Botham wouldn't let him go. He kept walking to get to Land's End, and then Chris suddenly realised, oh, bloody hell, my car's up in John McGroats, what am I going to do? So he had to square that with the Daily Mirror, had to pay for him to fly back up and get his car. On one of the trips, I was a press officer. Now, that really was a hospital pass. That was Aberdeen to Ipswich. Now, if I tell you that Beefy biffed one of the policemen on the nose on day two, and I had to cover that one up, somehow, telling you all sorts of porkies. And then we did Perpignan to Turin in the footsteps of the Emperor Hannibal. Now, what Ian Botham knew about the Emperor Hannibal could be written on the back of a postage stamp, but it led to great comic moments. There's a great lad called Greg Ritchie, who was an Australian batsman. Very, very funny man. Greg, like me, was astounded why every day at the end of it all, the elephants, I've got to stand up for this, the elephants would stand there, open their legs wide as if they were facing a fast bowler, and just stand there and pee for 30 minutes. A golden torrent would run down the road in these French villages. We went to places like, literally, Château-Neuf-de-Pape. There's a village called Château-Neuf-de-Pape. And they came up with a case of 1981 Cabernet Sauvignon for Botham and his hangers-on, including myself. Anyway, Greg was as equally astounded at just how much the elephants could defecate. It was astounding. One of my favourite animals, by the way. You go to Sri Lanka, everything stops at elephants for the parades, and I used to thoroughly approve of that. I think they're wonderful, noble beasts. Anyway, both of them had this idea that we'd play a bit of a prank on Greg Ritchie. I'll try to be as euphemistic as I can, but it basically involved Greg, who was a very, very heavy snorer, very, very heavy sleeper. He crept into his room one night with a lot of elephant deposits, and they continued to bung up Greg's loo. So when Greg had the call of nature about 4 a.m. in the morning, he plopped straight onto it, and that led to a lot of anger on behalf. It severed England Anglo-Australian relationships for at least 24 hours. That's the kind of thing that goes on tour, and it was a fantastic experience. I'll never forget doing so many things. I was doing a program for Radio 4, Adrian. It was on, they finished on, say, the Tuesday, and we were broadcasting it live the next night at 8 o'clock. It was called, because of the elephants, Botham Packs His Trunk. And I was sending things back from, this is 1988, sending things back from post offices all over the place, Julie Andrews, Pepsodent territory, walking through the Alps thinking, my God, but then I thought, I've got to find a post office. Sending it back to my producer, who was then sending me telegrams, no mobiles, no texts, no Twitter, telling me telegrams about how much he'd done so far. And when I got in there, got into the broadcasting house, the program started at 8:30. We are editing, just think about this, you're in the business as well, we are editing the last 25 minutes, and it's got to be bang on the nose while the first 35 minutes is going out. Now, Radio 4, as you know, Adrian, they're very precious. You know, they want the thing to be just right. They quite like the script 3 weeks before, and that's for a news story. So we're editing this, and all falling out of me. Absolute I'm in a terrible state. We finally hit it on the button with about 5 seconds to spare. And if I tell you that the first 3 pints didn't touch the sides, that was an interesting end to what was a remarkable few weeks. Emperor Hannibal.
And Botham, you got your biggest scoop out of Botham, didn't you?
1984, the mother-in-law interview. You're all too young to remember this. England had been on a very, very enjoyable hedonistic tour of New Zealand called the Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll Tour. And there was a lot of that went on. We'll draw a veil over that for a moment. But if I tell you that a lot of it was true. Anyway, yes. So Ian had a knee injury, genuine knee injury, and the West Indies were due in 84. He was allowed, to his great relief, because he wasn't a fan of Pakistan, to come back early to get his knee sorted out. Now, the Mail on Sunday ran a huge splash on it the previous Sunday about all the things that were going on, that Ian Botham and Alan Lambert implicated, blah, 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 blah. Their wives furious, etc. Questions asked in the House. Cue moral outrage from the body politic of England. You know, as Macaulay the historian once said, we know nobody more outraged than the English in one of their periodic fits of morality. Right, that was Thomas Barrington Macaulay in the 19th century. So I tracked Ian down at the Woodland Hostel in Northfield, Birmingham. So I'm sitting there, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, I brought a bottle of brandy with me, failed to prepare to fail. So we're sat there having a chat about all sorts of things. The phone rings, it's Elton John. So he's yakking away about his new album, all that sort of thing. What's going on here? Pouring him another one. Phone rings again, Eric Clapton. I knew he had famous showbiz friends, but I'm thinking, was like, wow, I'm way out of my league here. So eventually he said, you got your machine? He said, yeah, let's do a little chat. So I said to him, knowing that Ian didn't like Pakistan, I bet you're glad to be back here, you know. You're not a fan of Pakistan, are you? Now, there was a pause. And the great Terry Wogan, as you know, Adrian, was a great man for pauses on radio. You could read a lot into pauses. And he's looking at me. And he said, I could see his mind going. And he thought, oh, because we'd had a few brandies. And at 9:45 in the morning. And I've still got to go to Leicester to do a football interview, by the way. And then West Brom, Johnny Giles. I was due to interview him as well. It was a Friday morning. I think, oh, what's going on? He looked at me. He said, Pakistan. Pakistan, it's the kind of place to send your mother-in-law to. All expenses paid. And I'm looking at there, and through my befuddlement, I'm thinking, got a story here. And then he said, Jan had liked that. Jan, his mother-in-law, with whom he had a very good relationship. He liked her very much. He said, Jan would like that one. Off he goes, riffing about the inadequacies of Pakistan. Blah, blah, blah. And I thought, ooh. I'm not going to tell our office about this, because this wasn't 24/7 days in those days. It was old Radio 2 used to do the sport. I thought, well, hang on to this bit. So off I went to Leicester. Off I went to West Brom. Finally, I got back to Pebble Mill late afternoon, and I played it down the line. I said, just listen to this. And they all went, what? Bloody hell. What are we going to do with this? I said, well, it's above my pay grade. I just deliver. You're paid to make these decisions. They made, in my opinion, the right decision. They ran it on the sports desk 45 seconds the night before, Friday night. Full interview on Sport on 4. It was a very, very good program presented by Cliff Morgan. They ran it the next day. And then the lumpy stuff hit the fan. The Pakistan High Commissioner in London rang up my boss and threatened a fatwa on me. It was Salman Rushdie days. Threatened a fatwa on me and Ian Botham when he came out of his hospital bed at the Woodlands, Northfield. Now, fast forward, a move across the continent. At that time, one of my great mates, Bob Willis, was England captain. He was there with England, test match in Lahore, and they were there for 10 days, build up, and afterwards. The hotel staff downed tools. They refused to make the beds, give them any food. They said, you're on your own. Ian Botham has insulted our country. And the next 5 days of the test match, the disconsolate manager had to make baked beans on the primer stove at the ground for the England players. So the England players went hungry for about 10 days. I avoided the fatwa. And Ian Botham was hauled up before the beaks. And I sent a letter again trying to phone letter saying, Ian, my fault, I've got to take responsibility for this, I'll help you with a fine. Thank God he didn't. He didn't pick me up because it was a £1,000 fine. What's the £1,000 now in 1984 terms? Anyway, Ian got fined and I got away with it. But the funniest sequel was on the Monday, this interview was on the Friday, broadcast on the Saturday morning, Pakistan, the place to send your mother-in-law to. Ian's mother-in-law got 9 invites from national newspapers to go to Pakistan as a travel reporter. she declined because she's working education at the time. Fast forward 16 years, my first tour to Pakistan, and by the way, a really, really good place to go to, fantastic place. Everything works. Planes run on time, hotel bookings are available, unlike other tours I've been on. The only trouble is there's no alcohol available, so you've got to declare yourself as an alcoholic to qualify for alcohol. And that wasn't a problem for Her Majesty's press, including myself. So Jan, mother-in-law, she'd been booked by the Mirror as a travel reporter, and she came over and she said, what's Ian on about? This is a lovely country. These hotels are wonderful. So there was a good end product for Jan 16 years later, and I got away with it. And I've never forgotten Ian's generosity for making sure that I didn't take the rap as well. But it remains my only genuine world exclusive in 49 years.
I was just trying one of those Radio 4 pauses there, Pat.
Checking the audience were awake.
Yeah. Knight of the Realm, Sir Geoffrey Boycott. You've had one or two dealings with Jeff.
Sir Geoffrey. I was writing a book on the 100 Hundreds, guys that scored the 100 Hundreds. Now, all of you know it begins with W.G. Grace and it ends with Mark Ramprakash. Very good book. It came out in 2009.
I think there are a few people who brought their copies to be signed.
I hope so. I'll spend an eternity with you. I rang up Geoffrey. Said, right, Geoffrey, your last day. I knew the answer. Your last day as a cricketer. September the 12th, 1986, 5:21. Walked off the ground at Scarborough. Bloody annoyed. I've been run out. Makes a change, Geoffrey. I said. He took no notice of that. Makes a change. Anyway, Alan Walker.